Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
And are there any announcements? Yes.
Wednesday evening, Dharma Group will meet this Wednesday at my house.
For our dinner Saturday, we could still use a couple more people to volunteer to stay after and clean up. Are there any people who might want to participate in that way? Come see me afterwards and try to remember.
You want to stand up so they see you? You know, yes, Rainbow.
I noticed a carpet outside, and I don't know if people talked about it last week. I was over here, but the person who painted it should be commended and thanked.
I don't know if we had anything to do with it. Yeah, what's the story? What's on my mind to talk about today is a piece of story from the biography of the Buddha. I told a version of this in the children's program at 7 o'clock today. And today, I'll try to do the adult version. The life of the Buddha is very instructive. I think it's very nice, very helpful to take it as kind of a myth, and as myth, as mythology, to take it as not as face value, not literally, but rather as symbolic. And there's, from kind of archetypical or symbolic or mythological point of view, the life story of the Buddha is quite refined. It's very hits on some very important points about the spiritual life, about human life. And I think it's a very interesting story. And the piece that I want to tell you about is, and probably many of you know the story already, is when the Buddha was born, a seer, a sage, like the three kings who came to see Jesus, I guess, he came from the east, right? Well, there in the east, they came. One sage came to see the father and mother of the Buddha, and he looked and kind of looked at his bearing or something about him, and looked at the stars, and told his parents that this man, this child, would grow up to be one of two things: would either grow up to be a great king, a great emperor, or would grow up to be a Buddha. And they had some sense of what a Buddha was like. A Buddha was someone who certainly was not a king. Usually was someone who had renounced such positions as being a king or great wealth or great power, and who lived a life of awakening, of freedom, of peace, of compassion. And as maybe some parents are wont to do, rather than listening deeply to what the child should become or what the child wants to do, the parents will somehow direct or want to control what happens to the child, how they grow up, and their future. In the same way, the parents of the Buddha decided that what they wanted the Buddha to become is not a Buddha, but rather to become the next ruler, the next king, the next emperor. And what the sage said at the birth of the Buddha, he said, if this baby sees sickness, old age, and death, then this baby will become a Buddha. Now, sickness, age, old, and death are kind of like the universal characteristics of human life. So if you, in other words, if you allow this baby to confront life completely as it is, it's inevitable this person will become a Buddha and not become the ruler of your kingdom. So the father did his best to protect the Buddha from all contact with sickness, old age, and death. So when people were getting sick around the Buddha, they would all be ushered away, and, you know, out of the palace. No one old and ugly or sick or poor or you know, anything kind of that smacked of suffering or difficulty, or any people like that were kind of kept away from the Buddha. And the father, the king built three palaces, one for each of the three Indian seasons that they have. And the Buddha would rotate or live in these different palaces in different seasons in order to have the most ideal conditions. And he was protected behind these huge walls. He was isolated from, you know, the life of the people around him and the suffering of people around him. The experiences of everyday life where there's suffering, sickness, old age, and death is quite common. And instead of seeing these kinds of universal sights, the Buddha was provided with every possible type of education, every possible type of entertainment, of sports, of all kinds of things, in order to keep him happy and delighted. It's said at some in some of the stories they describe how, I suppose before he was married, he was provided with 40,000 dancing girls for every possible delight that he might want to have. And actually, as historically as the Buddhist texts get further and further away from the historical Buddha, kind of down through time, there's more and more of these dancing girls. Millions. But there was, you know, so he had all these delights, all these sensual pleasures. And then at some point, not until after he was married, when he was an adult, I think 29 years old, having lived this very isolated, refined, suburban life, he wandered forth. He snuck out of the palace. He got curious, what's out there beyond the palace walls? And his father realized that he couldn't keep him in the palace anymore, so he sent out his soldiers into the town to rid the streets of people who were sick and people who were old and people who were dead. So the Buddha wouldn't have to see any of that. And as the story continues, there was a deva, one of these heavenly beings that they have in India. Saw what was happening and saw that there was this very important opportunity here that might be missed, the opportunity to motivate or inspire the Buddha to become a Buddha, to Siddhartha, to go in the direction of Buddhahood. And so the deva flew down or floated down, whatever you do from heaven, and came to the into the streets and transformed himself first into a sick person. And so all the attempts of the soldiers to keep sick people away failed because this deva manifested himself as a sick person. The Buddha looked and said, "Who's that? What's that?" And his charioteer said, "Oh, that's a sick person. And it's the fate of everyone to sooner or later to get sick, and you too will be sick some point." And the Buddha said, "Wow." And so then he went out, he went further, and then in another street, the deva transformed himself into an old person, quite old and bent over with barely kind of, you know, the maybe long beard, barely scraping off the ground, all wrinkled. And the Buddha said, "What is that?" And the charioteer said, "That's a old person. It's the fate of everyone to be old. Sooner or later, you'll be old too, like that." And then it went further, and they saw a corpse And the Buddha said, "What is that? I've never seen that before." And he was explained that it's a fate to everyone to die. Sooner or later, you'll die also. And again, it was the big wow. What a shock. And it must be a great shock to reach the age of 29, to reach the age of adulthood, and for the first time to realize about death and sickness and old age and not have any sense of it. And then the story continues that as he continued going out into the town, the Deva, it's called the heavenly messenger, it's called the four heavenly messengers. And I like this idea that sickness, old age, and death, and the next one I'm going to mention, are called heavenly messengers. There's a way in Buddhism that suffering, the causes of suffering, the stress, our clingings, our attachments, are sometimes honored or gratefully respected because they're the place of our where we're going to develop ourselves, where we're going to grow up, where we're going to develop our freedom. We talked about with the children that I asked the children, you know, what would you like to have in a palace if you had, you know, if you were protected from all the things in the world and you could have lots of fun and have a good time, what would you have? And you can imagine they just have all kinds of wonderful things that they would have there. And one of them said, well, you become spoiled and all that. And then I asked them, what if you go out into the world and see sickness, old age, and death, what do you learn? What happens to you? What qualities of heart are developed? And these kids said wonderful things. They said things like caring, compassion, kindness, sharing, forgiveness. All these wonderful qualities we get born by the contact with real life and what really goes on with suffering. And so it's called Four Heavenly Messengers. This idea of honoring or respecting the things which are often, on first impression, you might think Buddhism wants to do away with. This is Ajahn Chah's final instructions to Ajahn Sumedho, a Westerner who is abbot in England. And his Thai teacher, his last instructions to him was, whenever you have feelings of love or hate for anything whatsoever, these will be your aids and partners in building spiritual virtue. It's a nice attitude, you know, your attachments, your hates, your anxieties, your greed, that they'll be your partners. You don't have to reject them, but really it's a way of honoring them, not giving in to them, not indulging in them, but really seeing them as this is a place where really kind of we confront ourselves and see our heart deeply and the spiritual qualities of forgiveness, of compassion, of openness, of can be born there. So then the fourth messenger came, the fourth transformation of the Deva, into a renunciant, into a person who had was living a renunciant life, which was quite common in India back then. And this person radiated peace and compassion. And the Buddha asked, you know, was struck by the peace and the compassion of this person. And the Buddha said, you know, what is that? What is that? And it was explained to him that this was a renunciant who was following the path of peace and of compassion, who was following the path to try to come to terms in a deep way with the suffering, sickness, old age, and death. And sickness, old age, and death is kind of shorthand for the human condition, the universal qualities of human conditions that none of us are free of. And one of the aspects of Buddhism that some people find quite joyful and quite liberating, quite inspiring, is that, at least in its teaching, Buddhism has a very realistic attitude towards suffering, a very direct attitude. There's a very, very little attempt in Buddhism, hopefully, to pretty up life and make it, you know, make sickness, old age, and death different than what it is, to kind of explain it away or to offer some kind of wonderful heavenly reward for it all because you slog through it and you get something great in the end. Rather, Buddhism says, you know, just look at it. This is really here and this is part of it. And there is unsatisfactory aspects of life. There is painful aspects of life, and that's the way life is. There's no way around that, except perhaps by denial. And for some people, that's a very refreshing message to hear, because perhaps because of their family background, religious background, whatever, social background, they have this idea that something is fundamentally wrong if there's something unsatisfactory in life. There's something fundamentally wrong if there's some suffering. If there's some sickness, old age, and death, or, you know, it's various forms of that. If they appear in life, life is something terrible. So it has to be fixed. We have to do something. We have to get away from it. We have to do something. And to learn that sickness, old age, and death are part of life, and we accept it as part of life, and that there is always going to be something unsatisfactory about life, some kind of suffering. For some people, it's a great relief to hear that. And it means you can kind of relax. You don't have to constantly be fighting and to fix things. It's okay just to be there for it. So the Buddha then went on, as you know, to follow the renunciant life and to try to come to terms with suffering. A couple of footnotes about the symbolism, perhaps, of the story. That this is a symbolic interpretation that the tradition often does. One is that they make a lot of emphasis on the fact that before the Buddha renounced his life, his palace lives, his rich, luxurious life, that he had all the pleasures that were available to persons to the maximum degree. He had all kinds of sensual pleasure, and he was a sensualist. And the Buddha talks about he had, you know, he was overly comforted. He was overly refined from all this kind of sensual experience. And it wasn't the rejection of those, but rather it was the kind of seeing through them and really experiencing life fully that allowed him to take the next step. And so to emphasize this is why the later tradition says, you know, actually there were millions of these dancing girls and courtesans. The Buddha, it wasn't the rejection of these kinds of pleasures. The Buddha had all those. He experienced those fully. And after experiencing them fully, then he moved on. He also was trained to the highest degree in the arts or the skills of his particular caste, of his particular position. He was a warrior caste. He was a warrior. That was his job. And he trained himself fully in that occupation and was mastered it fully. And only after mastering his occupation that he said, it said he went off when he was 29 to leave the world behind. And we kind of laugh at someone who's so isolated until 29. But some people are isolated until they're 19 or 17 or 16. Without any, I grew up, part of my growing up was in the suburbs of Los Angeles. And there was no sickness, old age, and death down there. As far as I could tell. It was really remarkable. Everybody had their own palaces. Maybe, I don't know what happened behind the palace walls, but everybody had, it wasn't exactly a wealthy neighborhood, but it was like, it was a ghost town. Everybody had their garages to the door, to the street. And no one was ever out in the streets. Everybody's, you know, in the house or in the backyard, but the front, there wasn't even front yards even. You could draw, you know, electric, you know, these automatic garage door openers, the door would flap open. The cars would go in, doors would flap down, and you'd never see anybody again. You never see sickness, old age, and death. And I'm not laughing. This is my experience. And, however, I also grew up some in Europe. And I remember in Norway, growing up there, visiting there, how sickness, old age, and death was much more part of the tapestry. It was wove in and out of life much more. And people died in the apartment buildings around where I was staying with my grandparents, and you know, we were all aware of it. We watched the bodies being carried out to the ambulances, and you know, much more real, in a sense. The idea of parents wanting to protect their children seems like maybe a very healthy thing to do, but it can go overboard. I think that the contact with the real life is what inspires us, or maybe moves us, or allows us really to develop a kind of depth. One of the children kept saying, he'd heard the story before, and he kept saying, the Buddha went into town, into the streets, and he went into the deep town. I don't know where he got the idea of deep town, but I like this, into the depths of life, you know. That's, you know, where the depths of life is. So the Buddha encountered suffering in this symbolic form, this kind of shorthand way we call sickness, old age, and death in Buddhism, and wanted to come to terms with it, and left the palace life. And then what he discovered, his the path of peace and compassion, was his solution or his resolution of this dilemma, this issue of sickness, old age, and death. And I think that in thinking about it today, I thought of maybe two ways of talking about this resolution. And perhaps one, there's an aspect of insight, really seeing deeply into the nature of suffering. And the other is the aspect of willingness, of learning a kind of willingness to feel suffering, to be present for sickness, old age, and death. When we encounter sickness, old age, and death, most of us, I think it comes together with a lot of baggage. We meet it with a lot of baggage. We don't just meet it with open hands, with open eyes and say, wow, that's interesting, or, whatever. But rather we have all this baggage. Being sick is wrong. There's all kinds of attitudes we have about sickness. Not to mention, maybe not even the least, is the American work ethic. If you're not out there working, something's wrong with you. It was very painful to see this in the monastery. Here we'd all renounced the palace life, right, and gone to these Buddhist monasteries in America, and the work ethic came along with us. And these monastic people would get sick, because everybody gets sick. And they were so anxious and neurotic about getting back to work in the monastery, because only then were they fulfilled, only then kind of were they doing it right. And the idea of just resting and taking it easy because you were sick was a hard thing for some of these monastics to appreciate. But we come with all kinds of baggage of what it means to be sick, or maybe the baggage of what it means to be healthy, and all the things we can do, and our identity that's tied up with being a certain kind of way that sometimes we can't be if we're sick. And my sister, for example, is very sick. She's been sick for years and years in various kinds of ways. And now she's fairly better, but periodically she's looked back at her illnesses, handicaps and things she's had. And she looks back, and at times she said, I was really grateful for all that, because it really stripped me of all these things, all these kind of superficial things I was concerned with and preoccupied by. And I saw there was much deeper aspects of life and deeper aspects of myself, deeper resources within me that I had no idea I had. And it was only by being sick and having everything stripped away from me that I really saw that. And then she would go on, and maybe after 10 years of this, at some point she said, but I've learned the lesson now. Please. Or we get, we're dying, or we're afraid of dying. We see death looming up in front of us. And we don't just see death, in a neutral way. We have a lot of baggage about what it means to die. And a lot of people's anxiety around death is often not with death itself, but for some people it's the fear of pain, it's the fear of abandonment, the fear of loneliness. Oddly enough, for some people it's the fear of failure. Death is the ultimate failure. You've done something wrong. You blew it because you're dying. You're 92 years old and you're dying, and you think you blew it. I don't know. I don't know if anybody really blows it by dying. But that happens to all of us. We're going to die. But we have all these attitudes about it that make it much more difficult. So what the insight does for us, paying careful attention to our life and to our workings of our mind, our attitudes, our beliefs, we get to kind of separate maybe the seed from the chaff, the kernel from the chaff. And much of what we identify with and relate to is the chaff, is all the superficial attitudes and baggage which we've gotten from all kinds of places, our fears, our anxieties, and our identifications, our preoccupations, are things we really feel unnecessary, but maybe not really necessary. The chaff, and what my insight does, it begins to separate, is the expression winnow? So winnow, is that pronounced? There's some words that I've only ever read. I never try to pronounce. And the inside, we begin seeing, we begin studying, we take great interest in all the different ways, all the attitudes and beliefs that we have, and we don't take it for granted. And I think that this is one of the great opportunities of mindfulness practice, is to really question all our assumptions and assume that everything is an assumption. It's a good attitude to have for a while, just pragmatically, just as a technique, just as this kind of a skillful means. question authority is a bumper sticker, right? You know, we can say question assumptions. And then we can do two parts, you know, question assumptions, and then footnote, everything is an assumption. But to really question it and look at these things deeply, what is our attitude towards sickness, old age, and death? And what are all the things we associate with it? And if we can separate out the chaff from the kernel still might have as part of it suffering. Insight doesn't protect you from suffering, doesn't protect any of us from suffering. So what good was it then? That's good, this Buddhism. It leaves me with suffering. It's part of life. If you want to be awake and present for life and to allow for these qualities of caring and compassion and peacefulness to really grow, we have to really discover and be present for, discover a capacity to be present for, I don't know if we want to say natural, but the natural suffering which is always there, which is, we can't do away from it. It's not always there in the sense that we're not always going around being sick or old or dying. But it's a universal aspect of human life is to have those things part of it. It's a poem by Jane Kenyon, and it's titled Otherwise. I got out of bed on two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birch wood. All morning I did the work I love. At noon I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls and planned another day just like this day. But one day I know it will be otherwise. So these are all parts. You know, people we love are going to die and get sick and we're going to get old. And it's beautiful, the descriptions of the Buddha when he talks about himself when he turned old. The tradition itself never allowed the Buddha to get old. And the further down historically you get away from the time of the Buddha, the less he got to be old. He always stayed, you know, this radiant 16-year-old, you know, prime of health. And most of the Buddha statues you see, right, maybe he's not 16, but he looks pretty, you know, pretty healthy. He looks, you know, pretty good. He doesn't look that old. What would you say he is? Oh, maybe about 30. But when the Buddha describes himself, he sometimes talked about himself being old. And he talks about being bent all over, so that, you know, completely bent over with this kind of head kind of below his shoulders. And he always talks about himself being all wrinkled, and like a prune. And he had, the Buddha had a bad back. And it's not kind of nice to know that he had a bad back too. He had these things too. You know, the Buddha wasn't, being a Buddha doesn't free you from bad backs and wrinkles. Getting old. So another part of Buddhist practice, once we got a sense that we can separate the chaff from the kernel of our life, then the next part, the other, is willingness. Is to discover a willingness or an allowance or an openness, many ways of saying it, to suffering. Not to put up any resistance to it or any justification for it or any denials of it. Just the suffering that needs to be there, suffering that's really part of life, to experience it fully and just experience it but not make a big deal of it. Let it kind of be, kind of come, and not let the chaff kind of make it more complicated, make it hurt more than it is. Let your pain be pain, and don't add, you know, the tremendous network of anxiety and worry and fear and self-pity and aversion and hate that could be added to it. All that is kind of the chaff. But the kernel itself is just pain. Someone we love dies, it's painful. I don't know if there's any way not to feel the pain unless, again, we shut ourselves down. So to be the willingness just to be there for pain. And I think one of the contributions of Buddhist practice to human life is it cultivates, it trains, it develops people who have that willingness to be present for suffering when suffering arises. And it can be a great solace, it can be a great support to other people around you if you have the ability to be in the presence of suffering completely naked, without trying to do anything about it, justifying it or denying it or all the different things. So these two things, the insight helps the willingness, and then the willingness helps the insight. And as all these kind of develop more and more, then the willingness becomes even larger in a sense, and we even have this willingness, paradoxically, to the chaff itself. And we're much more at ease than even having the chaff, even having all the baggage. We don't take it as heavy. The baggage gets lighter, in a sense. And I think that's my understanding, at least for tonight, of what the Buddha discovered in his resolution when he came to terms with suffering. He saw to the depth, really saw through, and really let go of all the chaff. And the mythological inspiration, the myth of the Buddha, is, at least in the mythological terms, supposed to inspire us to the possibility of moving in that direction, of beginning to kind of see the chaff from the kernel, to let the chaff kind of blow away in the wind. I lost my train of thought. Oh well. So these two things, to the insight and the willingness. And if we do that, then there's the other side of life, which life also has a lot of joy and a lot of happiness. And the ability to be fully present, that allowing that willingness allows actually us to be more fully present for the joy and the happiness of life also. Someone, unknown, wrote this. We live in a world torn between wanting to listen to the sound of a flower growing and wanting to ignore the sound of the sky falling. But sometimes being sensitive enough to the first process, we acquire the energy necessary to prevent the second. It also works the other way. To be sensitive enough to the sky falling, to be open to it, allows us fully to sense and feel and see the flower growing, all the joys of life. So I'll end with this quote. This is from there's a wonderful collection from the time of the Buddha of the nuns who were his disciples wrote these expressions, mostly expressions, kind of talk about their lives, but they wrote these poems or these expressions, spontaneous expressions of delight in the freedom and the peace and that they discovered in their practice and in life. When they came to this deep resolution of suffering. And it talks a little bit about this. It's kind of inspiring to read about, to hear these nuns talk about what they came to. One of them, there's a series of them, I'll just read them without any. Free woman, be free, as the moon is freed from the eclipse of the sun. With a free mind, without any debt, enjoy what has been given to you. Get rid of the tendency to judge yourself above, below, or equal to others. A nun who has self-possession and integrity will find the peace that nourishes and never causes surfeit. Be filled with all good things like the moon on the full moon day, completely, perfectly full of wisdom. Tear open the massive dark. I, a nun, trained and self-composed, established mindfulness and entered peace like an arrow. The elements of body and mind grew still. Happiness came. Everywhere clinging to pleasure was destroyed. The great dark was torn apart, and death was also destroyed. The great happiness of freedom, of great happiness that comes from, I think, this great willingness just to be alive to all, the full catastrophe, as some people have called it, to it all, and life as it is, to experience the joys and the sorrows with open hands. So that's the one way of interpreting the life of the Buddha for tonight. So you have any comments or questions? Yes.
Was the medical system and the anti-Buddhist, if the orientation is exactly the opposite?
Maybe it depends how it gets used. But, you know, what do you think?
Much of the thrust of medical education is to, by taking iron, deposing that.
So
little ability to sit with the suffering without the impulse to do something about it.
Before, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I guess, before they had the same kind of drugs they have now, it was a real struggle in hospitals between Buddhists and doctors around people who were dying. Because back then the tendency was if someone was uncomfortable as they were dying, they medicated them so much that they were unconscious. And Buddhism puts a tremendous value on remaining conscious. And so there was a struggle between the Buddhists who wanted to keep a person conscious enough. And now I think they can control medication better so people can stay conscious and stay fairly, usually stay fairly pain-free. But I think a lot of the medical profession at times involves denial. Just for example, I think some doctors are so uncomfortable with suffering, with these things, that they don't really treat the patients as full human beings with their own responsibility and try to make it better and try to pretty it or try to avoid. Like in Japan, where Japan to this day apparently, if someone has cancer, they're told they have, you know, appendicitis or something. You know, the Japanese are very much into denying the patients, letting the patient know that what's really going on. So that's an example, you know, maybe misuse of medicine. But medicine itself, it really helps people to be free of their illness. I think it's great. And be free of unnecessary pain. I think it's important. I don't think we want people to experience pain unnecessarily. But we also don't want people to... There's plenty of pain in life. Medicine's not going to do away with it. I don't think. That's your response?
There's a very difficult line distinguishing between necessary pain and unnecessary pain for both physicians and patients.
And sometimes what ends up happening, people get numbed. There are some kinds of pains, for example, not all, but some which are much better treated or better approached with mindfulness, with attention and awareness, to really kind of get into it rather than numbing oneself to it. You know, if you go to a doctor with tremendous shoulder pain and the doctor gives you a tranquilizer or gives you pain medication, you might never really go into the shoulder pain itself and realize the degree in which it might arise out of tension, out of how the mind is full of fear and anxiety. And so, so actually not taking the pain medication, really going into the physical pain directly, might open the door to a deeper part of our psyche that would be inaccessible otherwise. But this is not an area I know much about. One of the interpretations of the life of the Buddha is that this period of time where he got every possible need taken care of in his childhood is really a model for how we're supposed to take care of our children. Also, we want to take and give them every possible benefit we can possibly give them. Let them grow up as healthy and pain-free and all the opportunities that you can possibly afford for them, and that's a healthy thing. Take them to the best doctors, absolutely the best doctors, you know, and get them as good and healthy as you can. And some sooner or later, when they're 29 or or they get their own children, they realize there's more suffering to life than they thought. Pesha.
Pema Chodron, I must ask him the name first.
Close children.
She writes of a practice of breathing in pain, suffering, our own and everything in the world, and then breathing out joy and happiness. And you, through that, you learn to hold and be with suffering. But you don't get attached to it because the next thing you're doing is just breathing out.
Nice.
The joy.
Nice.
I love that.
It's a very nice practice. Yeah.
I tried that, and I got so depressed.
There's a lot of suffering out there. In here. Why out there? Yes.
You talked about the story of the Buddha being changed through the ages. What about his teachings? Were they kind of manipulated too?
Manipulated is a strong word. It's kind of it has an edge to it if you use the word manipulated. Embroidered. You know, there's as many different divisions within Buddhism of different directions the teachings went and developed as you find in Christianity, you know, all different denominations of Christianity. And some of it is historical development, you know. Any teaching needs to be adopted for particular times. And so there's a kind of change with the times and the conditions and the particular philosophies and metaphysics and worldview of the different cultures that Buddhism encounters. So there's natural changes which are quite appropriate. And then there's also real changes in the tradition. And you find a lot of changes. There's some changes that makes it look very, very different, radically different from what the historical Buddha was teaching. But one of the interesting question, the issue around that, so that we don't become fundamentalists, is that by the time that the scriptures were solidified, the ones that survived to this day, the Buddha's teaching almost certainly already gone through some development, some change. So the actual teachings of the Buddha might actually be forever inaccessible to us, what he actually had to teach. And rather we have, it was solidified, some centuries after he died. So we already have it in the process of change. So all we have is change. So it's for us to kind of come to terms with that and understand that the best we can. And one of the nice things I like about that is that ultimately the Buddha's teachings are not teachings to be adopted, but are teachings to be used as mirrors to see ourselves better in. And so it's okay they change. As long as the mirror is clean. Yes, please.
It seems to me that, not to over-glorify pain or anything, but that sometimes when you can really meet it honestly and deeply, that there is a kind of joy that can come from that, the being able to meet it kind of honestly.
Yes, I think so.
Younger you are, the more your avoidance of pain and suffering is, and the more stagnant
the kind of because of that point of view, I once asked one of my teachers. This was it was a symbolic question, so don't take it too, you know, just don't take it only as a literal point of view. I asked him, when I sit in meditation, should I sit in full lotus? Because when I sit in full lotus, it's a lot more difficult. And I find that then I deal with all the pain and the suffering of sitting in full lotus. And he said, no, you don't have to do that. Don't go out of your way to create. Don't go out of your way to create pain and suffering. just meet your suffering and meet your joy as it arises. Don't go out of your way to create either one or the other. Maybe that's enough. Last one, yes.
You have to make an announcement.
Oh yes, please.
If you're cooking this day, could you please come talk to me? And I particularly like to talk with Richard Wadinger and also Jennifer Reed. And also, if you have a Meyer lemon tree and could supply some number of Meyer lemons, could you come talk to me also? Thanks.